You don't have to hit it so loud when there's nobody in the room. Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call Senate State Affairs Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, April 27th, 2021. Let the record reflect the time is 3:31 p.m. Trying to get all of our members on board. Today, we're going to continue to meet remotely, except for myself, my committee aide, and the staff that's here helping us. We'll be live on the Teams video link. Public can watch as they always have. We have available Senator Costello, Senator Holland, Senator Kawasaki, and myself, Chair Schauer, will be in the room. We're going to continue to do this remote meeting, like I said, as we have for several weeks running, so I won't belabor the point on all the different issues and the why. We've talked about that quite a few times. I'd like to remind everybody, please mute yourself when you're not speaking. However, remember, I don't always see you on the screen, so if there's an issue, please just wave your hand, and if you have to, just unmute yourself and yell at me so I can hear you. Staff assisting us today, I've got Terrence from my office here. We got Carrie Cooperrider, Nate Williams with us to help. For committee members, I'm going to go ahead and take roll call, so if you would just state your name, please, where you're physically located in the building, your room number would be good for the purposes of establishing a quorum. So we'll start today in backwards order. We'll go with Senator Kawasaki.
Hi, this is Senator Kawasaki. I'm in room 7 in the state capitol.
Thank you, sir. Senator Holland.
Senator Roger Holland, room 113 in the state capitol.
Thank you, sir. And I'm going to go to Senator Costello, which may not be up yet, but I'll see if we got her audio. Okay, she'll be with us shortly. I know she's there. We're texting. She's trying to get into the team system, so I'll just announce. And Terrence, please remind me to make sure we announce when she comes up. For the record, we have a quorum to do business, and it's been determined we're going to do this continuing. We don't have any documents today, so that's the good news. I do. Okay, Senator Costello's still trying to get on, just so we have it. So we had. I have to make a statement here for the record because this kind of came out last Thursday afternoon state affairs meeting, also on Thursday night. So there were, yes, he is. You were sending the invite, right? Sorry. Sometimes you got to play it that way. There were a number of things, allegations that were made on last Thursday state affair meeting to include on the record that we were breaking the law by moving the bill from committee. This was SB 39 at the time. And as the chair, I went ahead and held SB 39 just to be assured we were doing business in accordance with uniform rules, statutory guidance, et cetera. I wasn't really sure. Because of the allegations, so I felt that it was the best thing to do was just hold them. Upon investigating the claims from a committee member on Thursday night, Friday morning, what we were able to run down is that we were operating within the rules and we were within normal operations to move the bill out of committee. We discussed the issues that were brought up at length with multiple stakeholders within the Capitol to be sure we were operating in the green. Everybody we talked to, and there was at least seven, concurred that that was the case, that we were in good shape. The fiscal notes was another thing that was brought up. We're loaded into the record on 28 January and have been there since that time for the original version. There will be new fiscal notes because that was another question that was asked, loaded in the system once the bill is moved from committee. That's, as I'm told, because it's not my area of expertise, that's staff, that's normal to have that happen. And anyone who wished to get the documents that didn't have them, they could have come to our office. So that's just, there's some miscommunication and maybe the inability to find some of the stuff, and that's fine, it happens. But those were there. So this, again, this is not, at this point, this is just to clear the records, folks, so that people understand. Based on those allegations, I don't want those sitting out there without clearing the record up. There was also comments made about the lack of time to review the bill, debate it, and work in amendments. And remember, as a reminder, SB 39 has been in the committee for almost 3 months. The newest version's been available for a couple of weeks. And I'd also note we had many hearings on the bill, including expert testimony and witness accounts. If committee members are absent for many of those meetings, especially when we had the time to debate the bill or we had important testimony taking place, it's beyond the chair's control to have everybody there during those times, but those are available for later. There have been multiple opportunities to amend the bill, and we even had 2 of 3 minority amendments were passed on Thursday's afternoon's meeting. This bill has a long way to go. Because some of the comments made it seem like this might be the last time we would have public testimony. And I know that because we were receiving many comments from the public that were confused by some of the things that were said. So unfortunately, we have to respond to these, and this process is just getting started on this bill. It's probably going to have at least 5 more committees with public testimony, et cetera. So I want to get that on the record. Thank you. There's a note. Senator Costello is on the record. I'll just have you in one moment, Mia. I'll bring you up for that after I go through the record. And so this bill has a long way to go. And to allege the process has not been followed is not founded, we believe, on factual circumstances. So I just, again, unfortunately have to correct the record just so that it's out there with that, because we were kind of hit on that and didn't see that coming. Unfortunately, this the circumstances have also had a ripple effect on the committee, and a number of bills are going to be delayed by 1 to 2 weeks due to the notice requirements. And unfortunately, I won't have the ability to renotice some of that work based on the desire. It appears that some folks don't want to waive the rules, which is fine. So we'll just have to wait another week or two to get things back on there. That's both majority and minority bills, but we will work to get state affairs back on the schedule as quickly as possible. I want to acknowledge that Senator Costello is in the room. Excuse me, not in the room, on the Teams. And Senator Costello, can you hear me?
Yeah, and I had a little bit of trouble getting on, but I am with you now, listening in the Capitol room, room 119. So thank you, Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Senator Costello. And I, again, folks, I apologize for having to do that. Sometimes it happens. You know, we have to clear the record up for both sides, and that's fine. And I would like to not talk about that anymore and just simply move on at this point so we can continue to get the work done to the people. And as far as I'm concerned, it's over and we're moving on with business. So we've got three items on today's agenda. The first one is going to be SB 17, Procurement Construction Contracts by the Governor. SB 91, Detention of Minors, sponsored by the Governor. And SB 92, Missing Persons Under 21 Years Old, sponsored by the Governor. We may have comments or questions from committee members at this time. If you do, please let me know. You can unmute. I can only see two of you. Okay, hearing none, we're going to move on to SB 117, Procurement Construction Contracts. As a note for the committee, we have the following people with us for invited testimony today, and we should have some public testimony as well, according to what I see online. So we should have Mike Lesman, DOT and PF Legislative Liaison, Charlie, boy, I hope I get this right, Deninger. I think I said that right. DOT and PF Chief Contracts Officer, Mike Lund, DOT, PNF, Northern Region Construction Engineer, and Rich Welsh, Department of Law Assistant Attorney General. So, Mr. Lesman, I think it's going to be you that's going to do the presentation. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon. This is Mike Lesman for the Legislative Record. I am the Legislative Liaison for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. Are you hearing me well?
I've got you loud and clear. Do we have a presentation ready to pull up? And everybody has that, correct? Okay. Unless one of the committee members speaks up that they don't have the presentation, go ahead and put yourself on the record, Mike, and please begin.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just want to clarify something. I'm on the Teams invite as well, and I'm having trouble with my audio, so I've left the Teams meeting, and I'm joining you via teleconference.
Okay, I see you on there, and that works just fine. You are loud and clear, so I believe everybody can hear you. They'll speak up if they can't.
Thank you, Chair Schauer. Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to introduce Senate Bill 117 to you today. This legislative proposal is before you because the department wants to be responsive to the needs of its contracting community. The exclusive purpose of this proposal is to grant the department authority to write regulations around a process which already exists between DOT and its contractors. Senate Bill 117 amends Alaska Statute 3630, that's the state's procurement code, by codifying the department's current use of construction manager, general contractor, or as we like to say, CMGC, construction contracting method. The CMGC contracting method provides for a two-phase contract in which the same contractor can provide construction-related services during both the pre-construction and construction phases of a project. Although this procurement method is not a specific option under current state procurement law, the department has been successfully using CMGC under the authority of the innovative procurements language, which you would find in Alaska Statute 3630308. This contracting method has been used for public facility projects, federal aid highway and federal aid bridge projects, new vessel construction, and Mr. Chair, we've been using this methodology for the past 15 years here in Alaska. It's been going on longer than that in the lower 48. CMGC is recognized in the Federal Highway Administration regulations. You'll find it in other states' DOT regulations. And, of course, it's commonly accepted practice in the construction industry. The department's experience has been that CMGC contracts can decrease contractor change orders, decrease administrative delays, and leverage departmental resources. Thus, the department and its contractors can more quickly improve Alaska's transportation infrastructure. Mr. Chair, once the CMGC contracting method is adopted into state law, the department will collaborate with the Associated General Contractors of Alaska and other stakeholders to adopt the regulations we need and the guidance materials, which will further refine and standardize this contracting method for application in Alaska. We look forward to providing our contracting community with clear and consistent sideboards that could improve the CMGC process. That really concludes my intro, Mr. Chairman. I have some good help with me today, as you mentioned. Our department's Chief Contracts Officer, Charlie Deininger, is available for questions. We have a construction engineer from Northern Region, Mike Lund, also available. Mike has a lot of CMGC construction management experience in the department. And we're joined by Assistant Attorney General Rick Welsh. Rick has worked with the department on CMGC contracts, and he was also a part of the Department of Law team that drafted this legislative proposal. I'm happy to provide you with a sectional analysis if that is your will. Otherwise, I'll conclude my comments here, Mr. Chair.
Okay, I'd like to thank you for that, but I'm going to open up the committee because I want to make sure through each step, and I'm a little unfamiliar with this myself, so it's not my lane. I'd like to make sure committee members have a chance in each part of this to speak. So does anybody have initial questions for Mike? Senator Kawasaki, I think. Yep, there you are.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a question. Just since CMCG has been used for 15 years and it mentions in the fiscal note that only 20 projects have been performed with that, why do you think that number is so low? And if we were to change this by making this sort of an open process, what do you anticipate the changes will look like?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, that's a great question. I don't know that changing or codifying this in state law would really result in a whole lot more projects being done under this methodology. It may, but frankly, it's a tool in our tool bag right now, and it has been for several years. It's really not right for every project, and I guess if you would like some more illumination on where it does fit in well, what kinds of projects it does fit in well for, I would encourage us to maybe move this on to Mr. Mike Lund, the construction engineer in Northern Region. He has a good experience with when this methodology is right and which projects it's maybe not best suited for.
Well, let's get that answer first. If Mr. Lund wants to jump on and answer Senator Kawasaki's question, let's try to get him done before we move on.
Good afternoon, everyone. Mike Lund, Department of Transportation, for the record. Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, like Mr. Lessman said, this is not a procurement tool for every project. Of course, or maybe not, everybody knows that we have the low bid process in statute now. That's how we do most of our business. We're frankly pretty good at that. And then we also have a process called design build in statute, and there are regulations developed around design build right now. And if you were to put those on two sides of the spectrum in terms of all the types of procurements that we would do in statute right now, CMGC kind of fits right in the middle of there. And so while we have design build right now as a tool in our toolbox, that is not the perfect fit for all of the procurement that we do. It's the fit for certain types of projects when the balance of risk and opportunity and innovation match up with what we're trying to put out on the street. That is the same thing with CMGC. It is a process that involves a contractor prior to committing to costs, where we can get a contractor's feedback and input into the physical construction of a project or phasing of a project. And of course, we don't need a contractor's input on all of those projects that we do on a regular basis, but there are certainly projects where we do, and it becomes to the state's advantage and to the public interest to do so. And we've been successful in doing that under the innovative procurement statute and ability thus far. So,
Mike, can you give a couple examples? I know Senator Kawasaki did ask kind of specifically, like what type of project themselves, maybe even the separate categories, just so we have an idea. You know, because I mean, a lot of us were just shaking our head, like, I don't know what that means. Is that building a bridge? Is it repairing a road? I mean, what kind of things are we talking about here?
Yes. Thank you, Chairman Schauer. Yeah, so in general, you're talking a higher complexity project. In Fairbanks, University Avenue is a CMGC contract and project right now. Frankly, we would not have been able to start executing that work because of the complex staging and phasing and underground and overhead utilities that exist on that project unless we had a contractor sitting at the table with us and saying, we can do this, we can't do that. If you want us to do this, this is what it's going to cost, or we could provide these alternatives to construction. We also constructed a CMGC project in Kivalina, the Kivalina School Site Access Road. That project is just getting finished up now, and the logistics, materials, availability in rural, remote Alaska, and all of the logistics around getting heavy equipment, materials out to a project to build that school site access road. Out in Western Alaska, that is often complicated, and we were able to work through several of those issues with a contractor in real time, again, prior to committing to costs. It's also heavily used and useful in the vertical construction industry. The UAF engineering building was procured using CMGC, and that allowed actually for that contract to shut down when there were some additional fiscal constraints, and then to restart that work without a contract closure and restarting and a lengthy claims process that provided some flexibility through that complicated building and all of its facilities. Does that address the question to anybody's satisfaction, or are there some follow-ons or some other things that I can weigh in on?
Chair Kawasaki, follow-up?
Yeah, just one brief follow-up. Thanks for those great examples, especially from Fairbanks. So you use the innovative procurement code under that to get a construction manager general contractor. Okay. And then, so I guess the question is, why hasn't that been more utilized before if you can already get a construction manager general contractor under the innovative procurement code?
Yep. So thank you, Senator Kawasaki, and through the chair. I nodded a yes to your first question, so just so that's on the record, yes. And to the second question, the innovative procurement process allows us to do to seek an approval for each project and say, this is what this project is going to look like in terms of how we go about and procure that with the contractor and these CMGC tools and principles. And that has been an extremely effective tool with the department's ability to partner with our local contracting community in terms of going down this avenue. But the problem with that is that we end up doing it on an ad hoc basis. Project by project, we have learned, contracting communities have learned, and we're at a point now where until we have something in statute, it's really difficult to develop regulations and sort of adopt some overriding policy on how we might do this on the next project outside of an innovative procurement waiver. So we've evolved this with the contracting community. We've learned some lessons that are Alaska specific. We've used some national guidance and experiences along the way, and we've made that sort of Alaskanized. And we're at the point now where we say, okay, here's a way to leverage this tool in the toolbox for the benefit of Alaskans as we deliver some of these complex or ripe for innovation type projects.
And then just one last question, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Thanks, Senator. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So under this, under either the innovative procurement or this bill, you wouldn't be required to get a low bid. You would just be able to get, like, the best value bid. And then how would you choose the specific contractors?
So, Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, the solicitation process is a request for proposals where there is a weight of technical qualifications, other categories like innovation, past experience, and there's also a category for price. How those are weighted depends on where the project is in development and what the specific needs are on that project. There's still very much a price component to the process, but selecting the initial contractor for the stage one pre-construction services, that's them, that's the contractor sitting down with the department, helping us put together the project before we commit to construction. That is very much a qualifications-based selection. And if we are able to negotiate a competitive price, and I say competitive because we have some tools inside of this process to capture and maintain the spirit of competition, that when we can agree on a price, then we move forward to construction.
Thank you, Mr. London. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir. Okay. Other questions from committee members this time? All right. As usual, it generates really good discussion, especially on bills you don't think that it will. You start getting some interesting questions. So we'll go on if you want. I believe you had somebody, and I forgot which one it was going to be. It might have been Mr. Lund to go over the sectional analysis. I can't remember which one you said.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Mike Lessman, legislative liaison for DOT and PF, and I'll take that sectional analysis if that's okay.
We are ready, sir. Put yourself on the record. Let's go.
Thank you. Section 1 adds CMGC methodology to Alaska Statute 3630-200, subparagraph C. Section 2 adds a new subsection C to 3630-250, which allows the department to exclude price criteria when awarding a pre-construction services contract under the CMGC contracting methodology. Section 3 adds a new section, 0.309 to 3630. This section is really the operative provision of the bill. It identifies CMGC, the CMGC method, as requiring a two-phase contract, one contract for pre-construction and another for construction services. In this section, it stipulates that the department awards the construction services contract only if the parties can reach an agreed price for construction services for a specific project scope and schedule. It also stipulates that if the parties cannot reach an agreed upon price, the department may contract with another contractor using another contracting method under the current state procurement code. Section 4, Mr. Chair, simply adds a definition for pre-construction services under AS 3630-990, the new subparagraph 28. And Section 5, again, getting at the heart of this proposal and us trying to meet our contracting community's needs, this section authorizes the department to adopt regulations that would further implement this act. And finally, in Section 6, you've got an effective date, an immediate effective date for the regulations that are referenced in Section 5 of the bill.
Okay, thank you. Questions on the sectional analysis from committee members? I think I'm going to be deferring to Senator Kawasaki. Some of this it seems to be rather familiar on some of this contracting language. Okay. At this time, then, we're seeing no further questions for the moment. We're going to go ahead and open up public testimony. Nobody's in the room, so I don't have to ask the question, but we do have some people online. Looks like we've got three, correct? So we're going to start with Charles McKee. Charles, you're with us. Welcome to Senate State Affairs. If you'd put yourself on the record with your name, who you represent, and begin your testimony. If you could keep it to about 2 to 3 minutes, I would appreciate it.
Yes, my name is Charles McKee. I'm a beneficiary of the McKee Trust, and I had emailed down to you, the committee, a packet of information, one of which is a certificate of business license, my name, and you can see where it's all cap, and I reserved to the beneficiary, me, Charles McKee, the name in mining and in farming, corporate and business. Doing so, I have reservations of rights. I'm a holder in due course. I have the trust established. And the similarity between contracts back in 1983, it was a joint bank account contract. I mean, I shared 50% of the revenue with the state, and it was identical to the fish tax bill 2 years ago that the Dunleavy administration wanted to change, and I opposed that, and then I got in trouble, and so I wanted to bring that to your attention. There is a difference, is I was going to sell advertising space in a newspaper that had been previously printed in 1907, Fairbanks, Alaska. I was just going to reproduce the paper, add additional pages to the run, and the revenue made off that was going to be shared with Pioneer Home. And so that's what you see in the newspaper clipping that I sent also to the committee. And so if you ever go into a court, my problem is the First Amendment right, and the religious right I sent down to you is when you go to court, the court will ask you to swear in, you raise your right hand, tell the truth, hope you got into the court, and then the court will ask you what your name is. Well, that comes out in all cap. So you just blaspheme the Holy Spirit. And then they put an injunction. They don't tell you what you've just done. It's non-disclosure. But you just blaspheme the Holy Spirit if you speak your name out loud. In that instance, I was shocked. I realized they do this with everybody. And this is a case of the judiciary, not the administration and not the legislative, but they have played an entrapment program against the people that are brought in to court and being exposed to the entrapment that they are then encumbered with because it's an injunction. And then they deny you your rights of religious liberty and, in some cases, freedom of speech, because if you're charged with a crime, they'll throw you into public defender agency, and then you're muffled right there.
Hey, Charles, and by the way, that's a little over 3 minutes. I've got some other testifiers and bills. If you could wrap it up, please. And just to be clear, do you support or oppose Senate Bill 117?
Well, I support it.
Okay.
But you got to understand, there's no statute of limitation of slander, libel and slander, when you do it to an individual maliciously. That's all.
Okay. Hey, thanks, Charles. Appreciate you calling in today. We're going to move on to Alicia Sierra. I hope I didn't say that too far off from, it looks like AGC. If you could put yourself on the record, Alicia, with your name, who you represent, welcome to Senate State Affairs. About 3 minutes, please.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Alicia Sierra, and I'm the Executive Director of the Associated General Contractors of Alaska. Chair Schauer and members of the Senate State Affairs Committee, I would like to speak on behalf of AGC's membership for Senate Bill 117 and appreciate the opportunity to testify today. AGC supports having CMGC as an additional tool in the toolbox as an alternative project delivery method for DOT. AGC is a statewide construction trade association representing more than 600 members, including contractors, specialty contractors, suppliers, and manufacturers in Alaska. Within our membership is much of Alaska's industrial and commercial construction industry. We unite the construction industry to focus on balanced advancement and work to foster and promote constructive legislation, regulation, and standards. CMGC is a common and accepted alternative project delivery method in construction and has been used in Alaska for more than a decade. AGC believes that when properly used and properly prepared, CMGC can be a great tool. However, we ask that you keep in mind that CMGC is not the only tool, and we encourage transparency and ample review when this tool is used to assure the best value for the state. SB 117 will benefit the construction industry in the state of Alaska by modifying procurement statutes to codify the CMGC procurement process. It would allow for DOT to use the CMGC process without having to submit an innovative procurement request to the Department of Law and FHWA or FAA for each project. This bill will modernize, clarify, and improve the state's procurement process and align Alaska with the majority of other states. Passage of this bill will also provide an opportunity for the industry to participate in the development of subsequent regulatory package that would remedy concerns about consistency in the use of CMGC on projects. As the leading construction association in Alaska, AGC respectfully requests a seat at the table throughout this entire process, especially as it relates to the subsequent development of a regulatory package. As leaders and experts in the construction industry, we have compiled a list of best practices from other states and other AGC chapters across the U.S. and look forward to the opportunity to share these best practices with our DOT partners. In closing, AGC supports this bill, which will simply add another tool to the DOT toolbox, and encourage you to advance this bill to the next committee. Thank you for hearing and considering AGC's testimony in support of this bill and our request to be involved in the process as it moves forward.
Thanks, Alicia. And just a quick answer so we don't go too far over here, but there was a couple places where you sound a little bit reticent. Are there any amendments or changes to this that AGC would support or does request or looking at for this bill?
We do have some, but it's not anything that is substantial or anything that a couple of language changes, but nothing that I have in front of me right now.
Thank you. If you could send those to Senate State Affairs at akleg.gov, I'd appreciate it so we could take a look at them. Thank you.
You got it.
Okay, moving on to Sarah Leff. Okay, Sarah, I'm just going to get that wrong. So, Sarah, put yourself on the record with your name, please, who you represent, and welcome to Senate State Affairs. About 3 minutes, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Sarah Lefebvre. I'm calling in from Fairbanks, Alaska. I work for one of the larger general contractors in the state of Alaska that is statewide, and I've worked in the construction industry for 23 years in the civil contracting. So I mirror Ms. Sarah's comments, and out of respect for your time, I won't repeat her most excellent points. The passage of this bill will ensure that the use of CMGC will be applied in a more consistent and clear manner across the three DOT regions, which has been a concern to the contracting community on past projects. And this may specifically come back around to Senator Kawasaki's questions regarding the process. Each CMGC has progressed in something of a silo, and some of the lessons learned have not necessarily been captured in subsequent projects and procurements, which has been frustrating for the contracting community. We feel that having this in statute allows the department to move forward with clear regulation and then eventually implement the use of a consistent CMGC handbook. There's been a draft version, but no resources have really been applied to finalizing that document because of the fact that CMGC did not exist in statute. So as DOT's industry partners, we look forward to the opportunity to participate in a regulatory process and creation of that handbook to improve the application of CMGC in the state of Alaska. Further, we find the timing to be very compelling because the opportunities before Alaska right now with the CARES Act and the federal infrastructure packages present an opportunity for DOT to perhaps accelerate and get some of their future year projects out onto the street, but that leaves a potential gap in some of the out years, and CMGC could be a very valuable tool at that point to fill in that gap so that Alaska can best maximize the opportunities before us right now. And again, to respond to your questions about amendments, that I'm also an AGC member. We do have some minor edits that we have proposed for the bill. We were considering advancing those to the Transportation Committee, but can definitely respectfully submit those to your committee also. They're pretty benign, and they have been vetted out through the DOT staff that testified earlier. And so we're happy to do that. And with that, I have no further comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. I appreciate calling in for testimony, and we would appreciate those documents so the committee members can look them over, and appreciate your time this afternoon. Okay, that being said, looks like that's all of the public testimony we have. Nobody else has called in, so this time I'm going to close public testimony. However, as we mentioned for amendments, anybody else that may not have made this meeting can submit their public testimony to us at SSTA Sierra Tango Alpha at akleg.gov. And we'll make sure those get read into the documents online. The amendment period for this, for Senate Bill 117, will be open until next Tuesday, May 4th, 2021 at 5 p.m. Sounds like there's some things coming our way, so we'll take a look at that. We're going to go ahead and set the bill aside. Actually, before I do that, just to make sure, do committee members have any other questions or comments before we move to the next one? Okay. So we're going to move on to the next item on the agenda. And I wouldn't want my bill to be named this today with this number, but so it is. We have Senate Bill 91 in front of us. It is detention of minors, so hopefully people won't get shivers down their spine because it's a new session with an entirely different bill. since SB 91 is a household name right now in Alaska. As a note for the committee, we have the following folks that are going to be online helping to testify with us. We have Tracy, boy, the names are tough today. Tracy Dumpling, Director, Matt Davidson, Suzanne Cunningham. And thank you for bringing this in front of Senate State Affairs. Please put yourself on the record, and I am not sure who's going to take the lead. So, Tracy, is that going to be you?
It is. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, when you're ready, on the record, and please begin.
Great. Good afternoon, Chair Schauer and Senate State Affairs Committee members. For the record, my name is Tracy Dumpling, and I'm the Director for the Division of Juvenile Justice in the Department of Health and Social Services. I want to thank you for the opportunity to present on SB 91, a bill to bring Alaska into compliance with recent changes to the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act, hereafter referred to as the JJDPA, which was initially enacted in 1974 and was recently reauthorized in 2018. The JJDPA is the primary piece of federal legislation that guides juvenile justice practices around the country, and lack of compliance with the JJDPA will lead to grant penalties on the division's major federal grant. SB 91 makes two changes in statute to bring us into compliance. First, the bill requires that minors who have been waived into the adult criminal justice system be held in juvenile facilities until they are age 18. Currently, minors subject to the automatic waiver or discretionary waiver statutes are held in adult jails and correctional facilities. Also, the bill expands the court findings that are necessary for non-delinquent minors to be held temporarily in a secure juvenile facility. The bill is limited in scope, and it intentionally has no impact on the crimes or sentences of minors who are subject to waiver into the adult justice system, nor will the bill have any net fiscal impact. If implemented, the bill will improve the conditions of confinement for minors that are currently held in adult facilities. Minors can be difficult to manage in adult facilities and are often held in segregation units. To accomplish this, the bill requires the Department of Corrections and the Department of Health and Social Services to develop an agreement about the holding of minors in DOC custody in juvenile facilities. Data provided today by the Department of Corrections identified 6 youth under the age of 18 who are currently held in DOC facilities statewide. The second change made by the bill deals with the limited circumstances when non-delinquent minors may be held temporarily in secure juvenile facilities pending another placement. These situations are very rare. They generally involve minors who are in the custody of Office of Children's Services, who've run away from placement and put themselves in a dangerous situation. The state seeks a court finding, and when I say the state there, that's Office of Children's Services, seeks a court finding under 4710.141, allowing those youth to be held securely for a very short period of time pending placement in another non-secure setting. The new federal JJDPA expands the court findings that are necessary before these minors may be detained, and it further limits the duration of the time that they can be held in secure holding. As I mentioned, these cases are rare. During the last 3 fiscal years, there have been a total of 3 youth held in this manner each year. In closing, we appreciate the governor's support of this important legislation and the cooperation of the Department of Corrections, Public Safety, and Law on the development of this proposal. Since its introduction to the legislature, we've received good feedback from the court system and other stakeholders, which we hope to address, continue to address during this process. Thank you for your time and support. I'm happy to answer any questions now or after Matt Davidson presents the sectional summary.
Okay, thanks, Tracy. We'll open that up, but just to be clear, when Matt does that, is he also going to discuss the summary of changes, or are you planning to not talk about that today?
Mr. Chairman?
I believe he is. Go ahead, Matt.
Okay, Matt, you're going to do both?
Yeah, I'm happy to. This is, for the record, this is Matt Davidson. I'm Matt, a social services program.
Matt, just before you go, sorry, I wanted to make sure I knew what we were getting into next. So for committee members, if they have questions for Tracy, open it up now before we get started on the more technical aspects. Senator Kawasaki?
Yeah, just a really brief question for Tracy, probably. When a minor's in a DJJ facility and then that minor turns 18, do they remain in the facility or are they automatically moved into an adult facility?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, so This bill is only specific to those youth who are charged under the auto waiver statute that would move at age 18. Because DJJ has jurisdiction of the delinquency matters up until age 19, sometimes even age 20, those youth would actually still stay in the DJJ facilities as under the delinquent minor statutes. This is solely for automatic waiver youth.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Tracy.
Yes, sir. So, Matt, I think at that point I'm seeing no other questions. So please begin. I guess we're going to do both, summary of changes and the sectional analysis.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to do that. I'll start with the sectional analysis, which I think believe was provided to the committee. Section 1 of the bill deals with the duties of the commissioner of the Department of Corrections and tells the Department of Corrections to enter into an agreement with the Department of Health and Social Services to detain minors who have been waived into the adult system in Division of Juvenile Justice facilities. Sections 2 and 3 of the bill deal with the runaway minors and the rare circumstances when a judge will order them to be held in a secure juvenile facility. Again, this is the other major component of the bill, the non-delinquent minors who are sometimes held in our facilities. Sections 4 and 5 deal with jurisdiction and applicability that's in Juvenile Justice Statute 4712. Section 6 is the conforming changes to to 4712-030A, which is what we refer to as the auto waiver statute, and refers to the new practice of holding auto waived youth in DJJ facilities until age 18. This section also updates the terms about the conditions of these court processes that apply to waived minors. So in this case, we've added the term transported, which is the current practice. It's not a change in practice, it's just a cleaning up of that statute. Section 7, called waiver of jurisdiction, is what we call the discretionary waiver. Again, these are minors who have been waived into the adult court and will now be held in juvenile facilities until age 18 once they're waived into the adult system. And it also, we've also updated the list of adult court practices that apply to these offenders. Section 8 is the meat of the bill in delinquency statute, which is a new section of delinquency statute, which we call minor offenders who are subject to adult court. And this describes the new requirements for holding minors in juvenile justice facilities who have been waived into the adult court system, and the limited circumstances when exceptions to the new rule would be allowed. And in layman's terms, the circumstances when a minor can be, these waived minors may be held in an adult facility is upon arrest, and if they're arrested in a community that does not have a juvenile facility, they, during that transportation phase, they can temporarily be held in an adult facility or lockup or jail pending transport to a juvenile justice facility. And that's the same for delinquent minors, may also be held with sight and sound separation from adult offenders pending transport to a juvenile facility. Section 8 also includes a provision allowing these waived minors to attend court in adult court settings for up to 4 hours without sight and sound separation from adult offenders, which is the current practice. This is a necessary provision for the adult court system. Otherwise, they'd have to come up with separate holding facilities to hold court hearings for these minors. And the third, which is the Section C and D of the new Section 8, deal with the provisions under federal law that allow the department to seek a exception to the rule for holding minors, allowing minors who should be in juvenile facilities under this law to be held in adult facilities. And the federal law is very specific about those rules, and so we've basically mirrored those here. Section 8 also includes a provision that authorizes the public defender agency to represent minors who the department wants to move to adult facilities in this and that was added in the last committee. Section 9 of the bill extends the same legal protections and residual parental rights to minors who are going to be held in DJJ facilities, that the same residual parental rights that are applied to other minor offenders. We have several sections. Section 10, 11 deal with their conforming changes dealing with the detention and arrest of minors. One of the things that we've identified in the last committee, and I'll talk about in this in the changes, is that the same we wanted in section 11, 12, 13, and 14 is all deals with clarifying, and that the drafters actually made some changes. So we added some new sections to this version I, which clarify that minors who are waived into the adult process, adult court system, need to be transported in the same manner as other minors, as delinquent minors. And so that's what sections 10 through 15 address. Excuse me, I'm just scrolling down my screen. Section 17 deals with temporary detention and makes conforming changes there to clarify that waived minors must be transported to a juvenile facility, unlike the current practice where they're transported to an adult facility. Section 18 clarifies for the division that information on these waived minors may be shared among the Department of Corrections and the Division of Juvenile Justice. Currently, the division's information dealing with delinquents is confidential and can only be shared for specific purposes. So we wanted to make sure we included allowances for sharing information about these waived minors. And Section 19 is an applicability clause, basically saying that it applies to minors who are in DOC custody on or after the effective date of the act. So, and then Section 19 is the effective date, which is coming up this year, July 1st of 2021. And so on that date, the expectation is that all minors in DOC custody would be transferred to DJJ at that time.
Okay, Matt, we're going to stop there for two things. One, for questions from the committee members. And we've also decided, as we have been discussing this via the text string, since it looks like most, if not all of us, have not read the version in the previous committee, the explanation of changes won't really do us a lot of good. So we'll just debate that as we go through if questions come up. And I also want to throw out to the committee members that Nancy Mead is here with us from the Alaska Court, I believe, for both of these bills. So if there is a lifeline that somebody wants a question from the courts, it would be appropriate. We can call Nancy up. She's in the room. So just let me know if you want a question for that agency as well. So that being said, we're going to stop here with committee members for questions or comments.
Senator Schauer, this is Senator Costello.
Go ahead.
I have a question about Section 17. It's a new subsection, and the second sentence mentions that a minor can be temporarily held in an adult correctional facility under certain conditions. Can we get an explanation of what does temporarily held mean, and are they also separated from sight and sound of the adults?
Whoever wants to take it. Go ahead, Matt.
Through the chair, Senator Costello, that's an excellent question. So currently, delinquent minors who are currently the clients of the division may be temporarily held in adult facilities pending transport to a juvenile facility, and that's specifically allowed in federal law. And so you'll see in 47.12.240, I have to look at the bill and see which section it is, but there's specific time allotments. It's 6 hours. It's actually very, very short, and then it goes on from there, where we have a rural exception and a weather exception. But generally, we are working, and the general tone of the federal act is that minors need to be provided sight and sound separation from adult offenders. They may be held temporarily in an adult facility with sight and sound separation, and there's very specific time frames associated with that. I'm talking about delinquent minors. And what this bill does is extend those same protections to waived minors. And so currently waived minors, the law allows for them to go directly to an adult jail. They can be arrested and taken directly to an adult jail, and the Delinquency Act does not prevent, does not call for sight and sound separation of them. With the current, the previous law did not call for that. Under the current federal act that we're coming to compliance with, the expectation is they have provided sight and sound separation even during those temporary holds pending transport to a juvenile facility.
Okay, thank you. And Senator Schauer, I have another question.
Go right ahead.
Matt, in the sectional, you had mentioned something about shared allowing shared information. What kind of information is shared, and who is it shared with, and does it deal with the minors who are waived into the adult system?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Costello, the expectation is that these minors will be come into Division of Juvenile Justice facilities, and we will provide care and services to them until age 18. And then most of them at age 18, if they have not been acquitted of their crimes or other circumstances, will be transferred to the Department of Corrections. And we wanted to make sure that we'd be sharing all health information about their conditions, what services have been provided to them. We wanted to specifically allow that in our statute to ensure that we could share that information, because otherwise our statute wouldn't necessarily, it doesn't specifically allow that. This is a new class of client for us. They're not delinquents. They are what we're calling waived minors in this statute, and so we wanted to make sure that we were very specific that we could continue the care for them and allow DOC that all the information we had regarding them.
Okay, thank you. And Matt, back to the 4712-240 regarding the time period of 6 hours. Sounds like this is aligning with federal law, but are there any other states that have less or more restrictive time periods, like 4 hours, let's say? I mean, are you aware of other states that are even, I don't know, more protective in a way of the minors being even in an adult facility?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, I am not aware of those different standards. I know that, Senator Begich was involved back in the day when these federal laws were enacted, and the state of Alaska actually specifically requested more time and exceptions for the weather that you'll see in 4712-240, just because of the rural conditions. Again, when possible, whenever possible, all minors and delinquent minors and now waived minors, the expectation is that they are moved immediately to a juvenile facility and not go to an adult facility. And in most cases, adult facilities don't want them to come into their facility. They are difficult to manage and different than their regular offenders. And so law enforcement works with the division to transfer their custody as soon as possible. But I could reach out to our research, do some research, and find out if there's other more limitations. But I know that we do very well in complying with these federal conditions at this time. We have very few violations or difficulty meeting these standards.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Costello. Other questions or comments from anybody? Like I said, I know, Matt, this is our first look at it, so I'm sure more will come up as we bring it back again. So barring no other questions at this time, we're going to move on to public testimony. And then, like I said, we will be bringing the bill back up where I think we'll probably have a chance to continue the debate. So at this time, opening public testimony on Senate Bill 91. Don't see anybody in the room, and I'm pretty sure that Nancy does not want to come up and testify on the bill. Okay. Do I have nobody online, correct? Okay, so we have nobody here or online to testify, so we're going to go ahead and close public testimony on Senate Bill 91 and Senate State Affairs. But as always, you can go ahead and send it in for the record to Senate State Affairs at ssta@akleg.gov. We'll get it uploaded into the record. We're going to go ahead and go with the same amendment period for all three of these bills. For SB 91, we'll be open until next Tuesday, May 4th, 2021 at 5 p.m. And then we'll bring it up at a future meeting where we can go over amendments with committee members and bring all the experts back. So at this time, we're going to put it to the side and appreciate everybody coming up for SB 91 today. Moving on to the third and final item on today's agenda, we're going to go on to SB 92, missing persons under 21 years old by request of the governor. We have the following people available with us today. For SB 92, we should have Catherine Monfrida, DPS Statewide Services Director, Paul Fussy, DPS Search and Rescue Coordinator, Lieutenant, and Kelly Howell. Thank you for bringing this to State Affairs today. And I'm not sure who's going to start off, so I'll let whoever, and Catherine, that might be you. Is that going to be correct?
Senator, that's correct.
Okay, Catherine, when you're ready, go ahead and put yourself on the record and begin the presentation.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Sauer and members of the State Senate Affairs Committee. For the record, my name is Catherine Monfrida, and I'm the Director of the Division of Statewide Services with the Department of Public Safety. Normally, Ms. Kelly Howell would be here to introduce the bill and assist with the presentation. However, she's not available this afternoon due to competing bills at other committees. Thank you for hearing this bill, SB 92, relating to missing persons under 21 years of age. In your packet on this bill, you should find the sponsor statement, a sectional analysis, and a copy of the short presentation I'd like to show this afternoon. It's a relatively simple bill, which brings state law into conformity with federal laws that pertains to the reporting of missing persons between the ages of 18 and 21. Is the slideshow up by any chance?
It is not at the moment, but we can select it, so stand by. Give me. If you want to continue, we'll have it pulled up here momentarily, so everybody should be able to see it, and we'll put it on Teams as well.
It should be in your packets as well. Slide two is where I will be starting now. Federal law, specifically Suzanne's Law, which was enacted in 2003, and a portion of the Adam Walsh Act enacted in 2006, collectively require law enforcement agencies to enter information pertaining to missing persons under the age of 21 into the National Crime Information Center and CIC database within 2 hours. Suzanne's Law is named after Suzanne Lyall, a student at the State University of New York at Albany, who disappeared in 1998 and has never been found. Adam Walsh was a 5-year-old boy who was abducted from a Sears department store in Florida in 1981. His head was found 2 weeks later in a drainage ditch. And slide three.
And Catherine, just before you go to slide three, I'm going to see where we are. I'm pulling up the briefing just so we can try to keep the public up with us as we go.
Okay.
Just give me one moment here. Okay, and we're going to go to the screen. Let me get it up to page two so the public can see it. We'll have this uploaded to BASIS as well. Almost there. Okay, continue, please, and thank you for your patience. We're on to slide three.
Slide three. Alaska's laws pertaining to reporting of missing persons have not been amended since they were enacted in the mid and late 1980s. Today, Alaska Statute 1865-620 requires law enforcement to report missing minors to the state missing person clearinghouse if not located within 48 hours of being reported missing. Alaska Statute 4710-141 requires the reporting of missing minors to state and national databases, which is currently called APSIN and NCIC, within 24 hours after a missing person report is completed, and Alaska Statute 4710-380 defines a runaway minor as being a person under the age of 18. The next slide, please. This slide summarizes the proposed changes, which will conform with federal law pertaining to missing persons under the age of 21, specifically that all reported missing people under the age of 21, as opposed to 18, are entered into state and national databases within 2 hours, as opposed to the current state requirements of 24 hours. Next slide. For informational purposes, training is already in place regarding the more restrictive federal requirements, and most state and local law enforcement agencies are already complying with the federal requirements. Programming of the state database, APSIN, has been completed as well to accommodate the more restrictive requirements. Next slide. The benefits of enacting this law are to remove conflicting and less restrictive statutory requirements achieving a faster state and nationwide notification for missing persons under 21 years of age, and the improved response for the vulnerable college-age population. Once entered into the national system, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children is notified and proactively offers assistance with these investigations. I can go into the sexual analysis or pause for questions.
Let's go ahead and pause for questions there, Catherine, real quick, for from committee members. Does anyone have anything at this time?
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. I appreciate this bill and the way it's going and why we're talking about 21-year-olds and that they're particularly vulnerable because they're college age. But what about people who are also vulnerable, like a 25-year-old that has a mental issue or a 65-year-old that has dementia? And why aren't they included as far as trying to ensure that they get onto the missing persons database?
This is through the chair, Senator Kawasaki. For the most part, we teach to enter a missing person into the system regardless of the age. To comply with federal law, however, we must do it 21 and under.
Senator Kawasaki,
thank you for the explanation.
Sure.
Thanks for the explanation, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sure. That does bring up a good question, though, which is, obviously, to follow federal law, we would have to enter those requirements, but there's nothing to say that we could not amend that to include others for the state requirements. Would that be correct?
Senator Showers, yes, that's certainly correct.
That's not a bad idea, Senator Kawasaki. We might want to talk about that one because you certainly don't want to miss people through the cracks, and I know that happens often, especially with dementia and other members that just wander off, and then it's hard to get into the system. So we should, if you want to take a look at that, that might be a good idea. So, okay, copy. And did you want to continue with the sectional analysis at this time? Well, let me make sure. Other questions from committee members? Anything else? Okay, hearing none, we'll go ahead with the sectional analysis when you're ready.
Section 1 removes the reference to 4710-141 in AS 1865-620 since the time required for entering missing persons into Apton and CIC is now specified in 1865-620. Section 2 adds a new subsection to AS 1865-620 to specify that law enforcement agencies must report a missing person under the age of 21 to Apton and NCIC within 2 hours of completing the report and must remove that information not later than 24 hours after learning the person's been located. And Section 3 amends 4710-141 paragraph A to remove language pertaining to the time of entry and time of removal from the state and national databases, since this will now be specified in Alaska Statute 1865-620. The bill has no specific effective date and would become law effective 90 days after being signed by the governor. That concludes our presentation. I thank you for your time, and I'm available again for questions.
All right, thanks, Catherine. Just one follow-up on what we asked previously. If we were to do something like that and add it, where you, for example, said anybody, within 2 hours, something like that, that would not affect how we are perceived as following federal law, correct, because we're simply being more restrictive on ourselves, but we would be meeting the federal law requirements if we had the 2 hours under 21 and an amendment that would say something to the effect of any person of certain categories, and that would be fine, correct? I guess what I want to verify is before we go down that path, we're not going to cause some other ripple into the federal section. Would that be true?
Senator Schauer, yeah, that's true. State law can always be more restrictive. It can't be less restrictive.
I got the supremacy. Copy that. Thank you. So other committee members, questions for Catherine at this time?
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Senator Kawasaki.
Yeah, and I don't know if Catherine, you're the best person to ask, or maybe if there's somebody from law enforcement, but I understand if there were a missing person, however long they were missing, to enter that into the system might take time. So I recognize that, and I was just curious if you had any, sort of thoughts on how long that would take a law enforcement officer, say in like a small jurisdiction, to be able to enter all that data in if we were to make it more comprehensive.
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, Lieutenant Fussy is on the phone from the state troopers, and I'm sure he can talk to you about how that works.
Lieutenant Fussy, put yourself on the record, and did you hear the question?
Yes, I did, Chairman. For the record, my name is Paul Fussy. I'm a lieutenant with the state troopers. And through the chair, Senator Kalsaki, when someone starts entering into the information into the NCIC or into apps, and it doesn't take that long. Majority of the time, they have a dispatch that will enter that information. So as the officer or the trooper is out looking for that individual, their dispatch could be entering that information at the same time.
Senator Kalsaki, follow up.
Thank you. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Okay. Other questions at this time for our experts that are with us from the committee?
Yes, Senator Schauer, this is Senator Costello. I was curious, once an individual is entered in the system, and then if they are found safe, what happens with that information? Is it deleted or is it saved? So if there's a repeat, I mean, what actually does happen once that information is not needed because the person is found?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, the information is deleted from the system. That doesn't mean that it might not still be, the existence of it is still in the logs, but it is deleted from the system when the person is located.
Senator Costello, follow up?
No, thank you, Senator Schauer.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments at this time? Okay, seeing and hearing none, we're going to continue with public testimony on Senate Bill 92. Opening public testimony this time. There's no one in the room, and I do not see anyone online to verify. So at this time, we're going to close public testimony on Senate Bill 92, but we will keep open the written testimony. As I said before, just for those that would look at the record later, the amendment period for SB 92 will be open until Tuesday, May 4, 2021 at 5 p.m., and that public testimony I mentioned can still be uploaded by sending it to Senate State Affairs, SSTA, at aklg.gov. We're going to go ahead and set this bill aside at this time, take it up at a future meeting. So I appreciate everybody coming in today to testify on all these different governor bills. The next meeting will be this Thursday, April 29th at 3:30 p.m., at which time we will be hearing SB 126, repeal 90-day session limit. That ought to be a fun discussion. And Senate Bill 120, Admin Regulation Reviewing Committee. Committee members, nothing to come down here for today, so thank you for taking the time. We'll get out of here a few minutes early. And we will see you on Thursday. We are adjourning at 4:37 p.m. Good afternoon.